What I find slightly unusual, Tomás, is that we started there this evening with the Hungarian dances. Now, I don't know about you, but I always think of them as the petit four, you might say, that come at the end of the meal, the encores, the little bits that dazzle and entertain and so forth. I mean, I remember being here one time when Maxim Vengerov finished off with a couple of these, and I think a few people in the audience, myself included, we feared for his violin. I mean, there was almost sparks coming off it, you know. But yet, he was able to put so much of himself into it. I was saying this to you some other time, I can't remember when, about the violin to us. I always think of it as being like the instrument that's closest to the human voice, if you could say that. I think of the piano as being orchestral, but the violin seems to me to be the closest to the human voice in the sense that it's not that it sounds like a voice, but that it conveys emotion, it conveys mood of the player. It's almost of the player. It's almost welded into them there, you know? And that's certainly what was coming across that night. His character was coming out in the playing that night.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think the piano versus the violin it's a very interesting dynamic. And one of the things that I'm always conscious of is that the violin emerges from the body of the artist, whereas the piano is something that you move in towards. I've actually been reading a book where there's more than one little comment and little stories and tales about piano playing. And it's a book by Alan Walker, and it's about Franz Liszt's last years of his life. Obviously, the part where he goes to Rome and becomes a monk. So it's the Abbé Liszt that he's talking about. But he might have been an abbé. He might have been a monk and been tonsured at that stage, but his snappy, slightly scathing humour was still with him. And one of his pupils was an 18-year-old Russian princess, and she was a rather large lady. And occasionally, he told this story, and it's been retold many times over, that she was a very large lady, and then she got married and became even larger. And that when she came in to play the piano, she would pull the grand piano towards her, and which Liszt felt was entirely correct given the balance of forces that existed between herself and the grand piano. But that for most people, including himself, he had to address and move himself in to adapt to the piano. So it was a very different process.
Taking that on, Tomás, if you think of all the music that's been written for piano and violin together, I always, when I hear a piece like that, like for instance Beethoven's violin sonatas, interesting, they're called Beethoven's violin sonatas, 10 of them, but it really is, it's really a duet between piano and violin. And there, the two work together, it seems to me almost like human voice, violin, orchestra, piano. And there's a great recording done of it by Maria João Pérez and Augustin Dumas, and the way they interact together just does seem to me like a singing voice and a grand musical voice coming together. But with regard to Augustin Dumas and João Pérez, let me tell you a story. They played a few years ago at the Killaloe Music Festival down in the church there in Killaloe, and I was with my wife Fanula, and she had studied years before that in Vienna. So during the concert, I became aware that I wasn't sure if she was entirely happy with the way the playing was going. She was the organiser of the festival. But, you know, she was beginning to move away, but there was no communication between us, and she was paying particular attention to what was going on the stage. And at the end of the concert, she went away quickly into the dressing room to speak to Augustin Dumas. And a few minutes later, she came back to me. She said, "Wasn't able to send him to you there," she said, "but the violin he was playing on," she said, "I recognised. It was my teacher's violin in Vienna."
Really?
And she was able to just recognise it there and then. And obviously her teacher from years ago is dead, and I think his widow would have sold it off, these instruments, as you know, they're pretty valuable, and this guy was playing on it.
People don't understand how important the instruments are, the actual instruments. Again, I'm going back to this book because I'm just obsessing and reading about it at the moment, but, you know, Liszt was obsessed with pianos and would travel. He'd travel anywhere for a piano. I mean, never mind Michelin 3-star, you know, worth a diversion. They knew good pianos and where they were. And, you know, part of his journey would be not to work out where they would overnight, and, of course, there were no hotels and chain hotels, and there's no... you know, Trivago. It's all
TripAdvisor,
and Yelp. So what it was that you know, there's a very good grand piano in the Abbey up here, just to the left of Lake Como. And this is what he did. I mean, they travelled through, and they would overnight in places where there was a particularly interesting instrument.
And they were even saying as well to Moss that you know, he was. Some people say he may even still have been the greatest pianist ever, even in terms of technical proficiency. But they said that the music he wrote, not only did it stretch any pianist who tried to play it, but it stretched the instrument itself. At the time, the instrument was barely able to keep up with what he was demanding of it, and that modern instruments are better able to do this now. You know, I think there, I was at a concert in Vienna a few years ago when Lang Lang was playing a piece by Liszt. Now, and I always think of Lang Lang as the modern day Liszt, not in a composer sense, but as the performer. If you think of him, I've never seen him in White Tie and Tails. I've seen him in golden Adidas shoes, and I've seen him coming onto stage, not looking solemn at all, but waving and smiling. I've seen him playing where, you know, he's in exceptionally difficult passages. He'll be looking up at the conductor and smiling, or looking out at the audience and smiling. Or if you've got these passages, you know, where, you know, you have the pianist or the piano and orchestra dialogue, conversing, you might say. And if there's a soloist within the orchestra, he'll turn to them and smile at them as they interact like this. He's a remarkable showman, full of chutzpah and fantastic technical proficiency as well, just like Liszt.
Which, of course, is, you know, what I suppose it's the high point of the evening, really, is the Liszt. You know,
it's the main course.
It's the main course. Now, I mean, obviously, we've dessert to come, but, you know, it's a magnificent piece.
I suppose tonight's drink to go with the music is self-evident. Suggests itself.
I think it is, as you can see here, a Tokaj.
A Tokaj. Mm. Now, which one of us is going to dominate the conversation in the next 5 minutes on Tokaj?
Well,
Mr. Clancy, you have one.
Well, I think we can start with Tokaj because Liszt was obsessed with Tokaj.
Yeah.
Had it sent to him even when he was in Rome. And many people did comment on the fact that he was one of the most luxuriously appointed monks that they had ever seen. And as a Franciscan, he seemed to have no difficulty at all having one of the best appointed cellars in Rome at the time when he was there. And Tokaj was his drink of choice. And we have letters about him describing what he wants to do is he wants to put the essence of Tokaj into his performance and the essence of his Tokaj into his composition. So he was very conscious of it. And I think, I mean, obviously the theme this evening is hungry. But it's a strange theme because it's the hungry of, you know, of Bartok. It's the hungry of Kodály and Brahms and Liszt. Now Brahms obviously was a Hamburg boy himself, but spent most of his life in Vienna. So it's really not even hungry. It's the Austro-Hungarian Empire that we're really celebrating tonight. And when people are talking about Hungarian dancers, certainly Brahms would have been thinking about the Austro-Hungarian Empire of dance. And that stretches across a very different, you know, borderland to what we see today. And in fact, includes practically everybody, currently engaged in a conflict from Ukraine back towards us in the middle of Europe. So the EU and its tensions and sort of arguments with Russia over where the European influence ends and where the Russian influence ends is actually being played out here tonight, because this is Europe's vision of Hungary, which is the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which runs right up towards the edge of the Crimea and includes huge chunks of and is actually fully embracing Ukraine. So when he's got these dancers, he's off thinking about all of that, the Romanian so when people talk about the gypsy fires, you know, with the dancing at the side of them, in fact, it's not the Hungarian gypsy fires. It embraces the Austro-Hungarian, which is the Romanian. And what you've got, and I suppose in the second half tonight, what we're going on to now, is you've got the modernists with Bartok and Kutai, and what are they? Both of those are basically explorers of this post-Austro-Hungarian Empire. And they both went out and did field recordings of these dances. And they came back, and that hugely influences, as we'll see, all of their work. But what they're doing is they're trying to figure out who are we now, in the absence of, after World War II, after World War I, really, sorry, who are we now? Whereas Brahms and Liszt were evoking, a very certain, and that's, vision of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it is strangely interesting to look at the music as well. There's a certain, as you say, when you're talking about the hors d'oeuvres, and you're talking about the Petit Four, these were glistening little jewels that, defined the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Whereas what you've got now in these two sets of dances from Kodály and from Bartók, these are much more soulful, ponderous, investigative, pensive.
And I think it's worth emphasising something you touched on there, Tomás, where we have in this part of the world, I suppose, we think of borders as being very fixed divisions. I mean, in Southeast Europe, they've been fluctuating even in our lives. We saw, for instance, Czechoslovakia dividing into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And indeed, Kodály set his piece in what is now Slovakia. Bartók was born in what is now Romania. And yet we're talking Hungary. And I'm thinking, for instance, Bartók sadly ended his life in as an exile in New York. And I was very fortunate there a few years ago. I was attending a concert in Budapest, and we went to visit the grave of Bartók, because after he died, he was buried in New York, and only many years later, after the end of the Cold War, were his remains returned to Hungary, to Budapest. And buried beside him is also the conductor, Sir George Schulte. Now, Schulte was a pupil of Bartók's, but Schulte lived a vagrant's life, that's the wrong thing, but he was almost stateless. He had to leave Hungary. He bid farewell to his father on a train station platform and never saw him again. His father died. He spent the war years in Switzerland. He wasn't allowed to work as a conductor. His permit only allowed him to work as a piano teacher. He won a competition there, which then, they allowed him to play a bit more. Then he took over the Bavarian State Opera, and of course, made his name really in Covent Garden. But if you read his memoirs, if you read Schulte's memoirs, he longed for Hungary, and yet he was stateless, essentially. He at that stage, he had taken out British citizenship. He got the knighthood. He was world-renowned. And now, finally, those two exiles, two great musical exiles, have ended up back side by side forever after in Hungary. But I think that's what they were, I suppose, expressing their identity through music more than anything else, because identity there in terms of borders and passports and the rest of it was very fluid. You mentioned, of course, the essence of Tokaj, Tomás, and of course it is indeed the ultimate Tokaj, of course, as you know, is called Essencia, which is the sweetest. It takes years and years and years and years to ferment. It may only reach an alcohol level of 4-5%, and it is just about indestructible and ageless. And it was almost regarded as almost like gold, or liquid gold. It's hardly an exaggeration to say so. You were saying, of course, that Liszt had it specially delivered to him. There was also a troop of Cossacks kept in Hungary all the time to escort the Tsar's delivery of Tokaj to Russia, to St. Petersburg at the time. So it really is absolutely a wine of legend. And it's interesting, I think you said as well about Liszt aimed to inject some of the fire of Tokaj into his music. And I've often tried to say that to people, what's the essence of Tokaj in terms of, compared to, say, a great Sauterne? For me, there are similarities, but then it goes off in its own direction, and it does, in fact, get a spiciness, I think.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen.
I often talk to people like, it may be wrong to say burnt orange, but caramelised orange peel, that sort of sharp, spicy character. It's not just a pure fruit flavour. There's a sharpness coming in there. And of course, that sharpness, I believe, is essential in the wine, because you've got this luscious, sumptuous sweetness, that massive velvet texture, which if it was there on its own would be just like a sort of a melting marshmallow in your mouth. But the sharp spike, the tang of the spicy character coming in there makes it an absolutely wonderful drink. Of course, celebrated by the Tsars and nearly ruined by the communists.
Which is exactly what I was thinking of while listening to the Piano Concerto number one. I mean, this is the thing. I would like to do an experiment. I think we need to be able to maybe bring in our glass of Tokaj in to the concert hall, and we need
not
to be able to.
In this one.
No. So I think we need to be able to bring them in. And now that they kind of have you noticed they leave the lights on nearly all the time now.
A bit disconcerting.
It is a little disconcerting. I mean, I think it's the element of drama, the theatrical element. I know what they're going for. I mean, you know, they're breaking down we're all one, breaking down the separation. But I am not one. I cannot play any of this. You know, even the triangle part, the famous triangle part, which I know you were, I could see your hand itching.
Excuse me, Tomas. You're talking to a man whose career was cut off cruelly at the age of six, having played the triangle successfully for one or two sessions in the school band. But I was delighted. Of course, this is why I love this Liszt concerto so much, is because in the third movement, maybe it's the only piece of music I know where the triangle almost takes centre stage. It's a bit like your trumpet playing.
Yes, I felt we were moving back towards trumpet and triangle playing, all right. But then, you see, now I am going to have to try and resist doing my whole Close Encounters of the Third Kind for the Kodály, because, of course, he, a lot of people really don't know his music. What they really know is the Kodály method. And, this idea of for musical instruction, very child-centered, hugely ahead of his time, trying not to impose forms of music onto children and have them reach bars and jump up over them as they go through, but rather let them feel their way through to the level that they should be at for each of them as they moved on. So very interesting, very beautiful way of teaching people. And then, of course, the famous hand gestures.
Tell me all about that, Tomas. I never quite got that.
It's the do-re-mi. And basically, again, part of the element of teaching the children is to show them the hand movements and try to give a structure to notes, a physical structure. So here I am. There's my hand in a fist. Now, I have no violence in me, and it's nothing coming towards you. But there's my do, okay? And then we slap out our fingers like that, and we have our re. And then we can drop them down and we can make another sound. We can push them, we can put the hands lower or upper. We can move the fingers up and down, and we're showing how it moves up and how it moves down. And it's a very effective way of teaching children, musical notation before musical notation. And, of course, made famous, made infamous by François Truffaut, the great French film director, who brought it into the structure of the communication with the aliens in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
I never knew what that was about.
Well, that's what that was about. So I thought to myself, perhaps the aliens, perhaps they were looking and they're going, why is he trying to do this with a childish, puerile method of communication with us using Kodály? But in fact, what it is, it's an international, the international language of music, and then made in a visual form. It's a very beautiful moment in the film and a fantastic, endorsement of Kodály's whole legacy.
Well, that was saying, wasn't that directed by Steven Spielberg?
Truffaut wasn't directing it. He was actually an actor in it. So he's the exotic musicologist and communicator, and comes in and does it extremely well, moving his hands back and forward with the huge alien spacecraft illuminating lights. Do 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 boom, and he's moving his hands like do 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 do. And that, again, it's part of the teaching process that Kodály was, that is probably his greatest legacy. I mean, we love his music, but probably that's the lingering legacy.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing.